Nothing prepared. And I make no apologies for that. I'd like to turn this mic over to Seth Winner, a professional sound archivist. He's also on the staff here at Rodgers and Hammerstein Sound Archives.
Well, to most of you in this organization, my face is rather prominent every year in certain projects I've worked on, as well as with the Vocal Record Collector Society, and in the capacity of what work I do on the side, which is with my corporation. One of the most important projects that I've worked on in the last 2 years is with this gentleman sitting right here, who is the grandson of Eddie Cantor, Brian Gary, who is also a producer, songwriter. What was it, Late Night Comic was the Broadway show. And Brian was referred to me through another go-between, and we've had a very long and successful collaboration in the last couple of years producing a number of CDs, namely on his own label, Original Cast.
That's not my label.
Oh, well, you're associated with the label.
Yes.
As well as a 2-CD set that just came out on Sony Legacy of all the Eddie Cantor Columbia recordings. And I thought it was a very good idea, since ARSC was in New York and Brian and I are here, that we should have a presentation. So without any further delay, let me introduce Brian Gary.
Thank you. Thank you. I understand there was a subject right before I was on about dating your albums, and I've been doing that for the last several years for lack of a woman in my life, but anyway. No, actually, I just wanted to say something that's absolutely coincidental. Today would have been my grandmother and grandfather's 80th wedding anniversary. So if they were around, this would have been the day. But anyway, what I'm here really to talk about is how these Eddie Cantor recordings have become prominent now on CDs. And as Seth was saying, a lot of it has to do with all the work we've been doing here in New York to get these things accomplished. And it was no easy task, because I'll approach a record company now where they'll have somebody about 25 years old who's the head of the label, and they'll ask me many questions like, who was Eddie Cantor, or who is Eddie Cantor? One guy said, oh, he's a jazz musician, isn't he? And I said, no, I don't think so. I never heard him do any jazz songs. But anyway, it's been an arduous task to try to get these CDs out there. And I had approached this idea, I think, around 1988, when CDs had just come into prominence. And I was very interested in taking all of these old recordings and trying to clean them up for CD and maybe get some of the unreleased material out. And the first label I thought of approaching was RCA, because there were that was really the first label he ever recorded for. And I thought it might be an interesting idea to go there first. And I had an idea of how I would approach it. So I checked around to see who was in charge, and there was a man named Don Wardell out in California who was in charge. And I met with great resistance out there, trying to talk him into it, because he was mainly interested in releasing Elvis, Elvis, Elvis. One Elvis Presley recording after another on CD, which is understandable, sold a lot. But I thought that there should be an Eddie Cantor CD out there as well. There was absolutely nothing in the bins in all the major record stores. So I continuously followed up with him and kept asking him about this, as well as some other ideas I had for other people on CD, and met with resistance every single time. It was, maybe we'll get to it eventually, and just really no interest. Until one day, 1992, I think it was. Yeah, 1992 or late 1991. I was talking to Ron Fermanek, and I don't know if any of you know who he is, but he does a lot of archival work and is a major collector. And he said, we were talking about the Eddie Cantor possibilities on CD, and he says, well, you know, there's somebody new at RCA now. And I said, there is? And, you know, to me, that's like another possibility here, another door about to be opened up. And he says, yes, there's a man by the name of Paul Williams. And I said, oh, Los Angeles, right? He says, no, right here in New York. I said, this can't be true. I mean, this is going to make things a little bit easier, you know, after all this. And he says, why don't you give it a try? And I certainly did. I got on the phone immediately and contacted Paul Williams, who was fairly receptive. You know, it was amazing not to meet with a brick wall immediately. And he said, all right. He says, give me about 2 weeks on this. I'll approach this idea. And what he did was obviously go to the record stores and found out that there was no Eddie Cantor in the record stores. So he came back to me, he says, okay, we're interested in your doing it. Thus became the very first Best of Eddie Cantor, a centennial celebration, which was in honor of his 100th birthday. So I was absolutely thrilled with this concept, and also the idea of how I was going to approach this CD, which was not only to include the very first record he ever made for Victor, but also to take an album that was out in 1957 called The Best of Eddie Cantor, which was virtually the last record he ever made, and try to restore the spoken intros, because my grandfather had recorded the album with a lot of famous musicians, Perry Botkin, and an immense amount of wonderful West Coast musicians, who were mostly, I think, known for big band and jazz, and the orchestrations were wonderful, but for some reason, I don't know what it was, in the reissues of this album, they had taken away all of the spoken intros to the songs. And I thought one of the things I wanted to do was, when it comes out on CD, is get those spoken intros back onto the CD. So that's exactly what I did. And actually, if you're queued up there, I'll give you an example of one of the things that had been deleted that I've now restored to the CD.
One of the best friends I have in the world is a guy with the biggest nose and a heart to match, Jimmy Durante. When I was a singing waiter in Coney Island, Jimmy was my piano player. He couldn't play very well, but then I was no Caruso myself. Even in those days, James had a language all his own. He makes up words Webster never would have dreamed of. But you know exactly what he means. For instance, Jimmy won't fly. Several weeks ago, we were to play a benefit in the East. We were in Los Angeles. I begged Jimmy to take a plane. He said, "I ain't flying, Eddie. If Mother Nature wanted me to fly, she'd have made me with feathers." All of this leads into a song which Jimmy brought me many years ago and which I've never stopped singing. I enjoy it.
And that's that. So that's one of the spoken intros that I restored to this album. Now, I also looked very diligently for unreleased material and found out that there were four sides that he recorded that never did get released throughout his whole lifetime and his association with RCA. So I did manage to find three out of the four, one of which I cannot find. One of the four I really can't, and of course I'll tell all of you the title of it, and if any of you do know anybody that might possibly have this, this is the one missing Eddie Cantor Victor side, and I will probably be doing a volume two for them because they only have a little bit more to go to release all the Eddie Cantor from Victor. So I'm hoping to do that soon, and I'm hoping to find this one extra track. But the title is Sonny Boy. He actually recorded his own version of Sonny Boy, but it doesn't seem to be available anywhere in the Victor catalog. Although, as I say, I did find three things that were unreleased, and I'll play you one of those right now. This is a song called Does an Elephant Love Peanuts? And I thought it was a fun recording and decided to release it on this album and give people the benefit of hearing something that hadn't been released before. So this is Does an Elephant Love Peanuts?
You ask me if I love you, do I, don't I? Same old question 20 times a day. I swear by stars above you, do I, don't I? You're not convinced, here's all that I can say. Does an elephant love peanuts? Does he? Does a goldfish love a bowl? Does an ostrich love to stand while his head's down in a sand pile? Does a hot dog love a roll? Does a bumblebee love honey? Does he? Does an oyster love a stew? When it comes to table manners, does a monkey love bananas? If he does, then baby, I love you. Does a horsefly love the horses? Does he? Does a squirrel love a nut? Does a bold gorilla thriller, shy romantic Miss Gorilla? Does a hobo love a mutt? Does a tomcat love a back fence? Does he? Does a cow just love to moo? Does a rooster's cock-a-doodle make a hen go off her noodle? If he does, then baby, I love you. Thank you. do they? Does a piggy love to squeal? Does a goose love to meander when she's found the propaganda? Has an eel got sex appeal? Does a big giraffe love necking? Does he? Does a dove just love to coo? Does a herring feel quite tickled just as soon as he gets pickled? If he does, then baby, I love you.
There you go. Yes. Yes?
Belongs to the Andy Sinella School. It may be him.
Okay. All right. I think I might have put some of the musicians on that on the listing in the CD. I can't remember for sure.
I could be wrong, but I said Andy Sinella School because there were so many people that went into this thing because it was a great success of making maybe a number of thousands of recordings.
Okay. All right. One thing I have to tell you about is the Carnegie Hall CD that I put out, because this was an amazing find. I went out to Los Angeles and happened to find an audio tape, a reel-to-reel audio tape, of my grandfather's appearance at Carnegie Hall, which had been rumored to be recorded, but nobody really knew if it really existed, because a fake version of it came out in the early 60s on Audio Fidelity, which everybody thought was the real thing, but it was not. And I thought, what a great thing if I could put out this 1950 concert of my grandfather's one-man show. So I happened to be speaking to Will Friedwald, and some of you may know his work. He does a lot of liner notes and a lot of work in this area. And I asked him, who would I speak to, and who do I find to help restore these recordings? And he had recommended Seth Winter. So I called up Seth, and I think I played him a little bit of this 3 3/4 IPS audio, and the only thing that Seth kept saying to me is, where's the discs? Where's the discs? This is a very important three words in his vocabulary. Where's the discs? And so I did a little more research, and I did find the discs, and we transferred them to audio tape, I guess, after that. And he did an amazing job cleaning this up. I mean, it was in good shape, pretty good shape. One thing that was kind of interesting is that with all the good quality that we were finding, there was also something very strange going on. We heard an opera singer in the background, and Seth pointed it out to me, and I thought, oh, now how can we get rid of this? There was no way to get rid of that. It was either on the discs from when they were making the actual discs at Carnegie Hall, or there was actually an opera singer doing a show somewhere in Carnegie Hall at the same time my grandfather was on stage. But I figured you'd get two for the price of one, so it's a bargain. Although we never found out who it was, who was singing. But anyway, it's very, very slight. So I'd like to play you just a little bit of the Carnegie Hall so you could hear one of the amazing things that I found on there. Listen to this.
Before we start this evening, I want you to meet a gentleman who last year was a contender for an Oscar in Hollywood, having written the a Woody Woodpecker song. His name is George Tibbles. Here he is. George, get up and take it. The other gentleman, I do not know at all. He was left over here from the Boston Symphony. What is your name, young man? He says his name is Arthur Siegel. Let's make him get up, huh?
The amazing thing about that is we have Arthur Siegel here today. He was the piano player for that show. There he is, right over there. One of the other unique things about this Carnegie Hall show is that it's not just Eddie Cantor, the song and dance man. You get a real insight into what he was like as a human being and his interest in politics and as a humanitarian. So one of the things I wanted to play for you was a very early reference to somebody on the political end of things. And I think you'll find this interesting.
We're going to talk about show business. Show business that many of you knew, and that I knew, and still know. And it should be a very nostalgic evening, and things that you've heard time and time again, and it may recall memories of a much more pleasant day, a day without the H-bomb, or Senator McCarthy, or other evil things that want to destroy mankind.
1950, so it was pretty early on to make a public reference to that. So anyway, I found that album to be extremely interesting, and it's been doing just incredibly well. And we decided to then put out a second disc that I found out in Los Angeles once again. But this time, I was out in California, and I had to transfer the disc immediately. It was actually on audio tape once again. So I thought maybe I could just use the audio tape. But of course, Seth, where's the discs? Where's the discs? So when I went out to California, I asked Will Friedwald, I called him here in New York, I said, is there anybody out there that can help me on this? So the kind of West Coast Seth winner is a guy named Stephen Lasker, an incredibly nice guy and a great sound person, and he transferred a show that I thought was absolutely amazing. It was a 1940 radio show that never got on the air because President Roosevelt took over the airwaves that night and would not allow anything else to be aired, and my grandfather had an audience of 1,300 people over at NBC here in New York and wanted to entertain them, so he did. But fortunately, somebody recorded the show onto discs, and that's where the show that never aired comes into being, because I thought this was a rarity. This is a show that literally no one heard except that studio audience that night. So I decided to put that out on CD as well. And there are some slight flaws in it. Dinah Shore, there's a tiny bit of a skip on her song that Seth and I just couldn't figure out any way of fixing, so we let it ride just for the sake of having the entire performance. And another thing that I get taken to task for a lot is the question and answer period on this disc, but it was not set up to be recorded. There were questions being yelled out from the audience, and you could hear my grandfather's responses, and if you listen really carefully, you can hear what the questions are. Put on your headphones or whatever. So it's just a remarkable recording. But one of the things that's most remarkable is a wonderful song that I heard on there called Oh Susanna, Dust Off That Old Piano. And I just always found it a catchy song. I didn't know why it wasn't a hit record for my grandfather, but he made a lot of recordings. He made a lot of songs popular without a recording. Just the sheet music sold a whole lot. So I just wanted to introduce you to somebody here today, because once again, it's amazing. These people are here to talk about something that happened in 1935, which is when this song was first conceived. I'd like you to meet the man who wrote Oh Susanna. The melody to that song is written by Gerald Marx, right over here. Gerald's going to tell... Yeah, your microphone's on. Gerald's going to tell us a very quick story about how that song came into being for my grandfather.
You want it quick?
What?
A songwriter does a lot of talking. He doesn't know what quick means. this is one of three... thing that interests me really about this is that this is one of three of my songs that got over to the public with one performance. A song of mine called All of Me was sung by a woman by the name of Belle Baker once. The first time, and it went around the world. A song by the name of Is It True What They Say About Dixie, which I hated, was, yes, I thought it was old-fashioned. Who in the world writes about magnolias around the cabin door today? But Jolson didn't even care whether it was dated. All he could remember was that he had made several million dollars singing songs like this. And the third song was this one, Dust Off That Old Piano. And I do remember that at the time, Irving Caesar and a writer by the name of Sammy Lerner and I were writing together for about 12 years, and mostly at night. And one of the songs we wrote one night was Oh Susanna, Dust Off That Old Piano. And then it was put on a pile with the rest of them, because we couldn't get rid of every single song we wrote. We wrote so many. So, but one day, Caesar said, what have we got that we could sell? And I said, a song called O Susanna, Dust Off That Old Piano. So he said, who should get it? What publisher should have it? I said, well, it's a novelty song, and Shapira Bernstein is the biggest novelty publisher at the moment, and it ought to go to them. So he grabbed the telephone immediately, called Louis Bernstein, the head of the company, said, Louis, Gerald Marx and I are coming right over with the goddamnedest song that you ever heard. If you don't like this song, there's something wrong with this goddamn business. He said, now we'll be right over, and hung up. That was Caesar. He didn't know what to ask. Have you got anybody in your office at the moment that you're talking to, or is this uncomfortable for you or anything? He just knew that he was coming right over, and he said, let's go. So, okay, we went over, sat down, played this. Well, no, before I played the song, Caesar started to talk business. Without Louis Bernstein having heard a word or a note, he asked for an advance against royalties that was bigger than I had ever heard of. Then he asked for bigger royalties on the song, and Louis said, Irving, play the song. Let me hear it. It may be worth more than you even think. Now, if you do, I know music publishers, and if you ever heard of a music publisher who thinks your song is worth more than you do. So, yeah. So, anyway, we played it for him. Louis liked the song. Then Caesar went on to more business. He wanted now he wanted something that I had never heard of before, and that was a piece of the ASCAP performance royalties. Never heard of that, neither did anybody else in the business. And Louis finally gave in and said, Irving, this is not done at all in this business, but if you'll keep it a secret, I'll give you a little piece of the ASCAP performance royalties. Fine, Daddy. Anyway, it went on and on and on, got everything that anybody could ask for. And then all of a sudden, Caesar got up from his chair. And in the meantime, I was getting rich because I was going to get all this money, or a third of it anyway. And, God, this was one of my big days. And all of a sudden, Caesar bounced out of his chair and said to Louis, Louis, I'll let you know, and walked out of the office. And, of course, I went out, followed him. And I couldn't believe this. We came to sell a song. We got downstairs, and I said, Irving, what was that all about? Here's a man gave you everything under the sun, things that you never even got in your life. And here we're guaranteed a number one plug on from one of the biggest houses in the country. And Caesar said, you're right. I want to tell you something. Louis Bernstein is a good song picker. If he thinks this song is such a hit that he'll give us all that extra money, he said, let's go back and publish it ourselves and keep the money. I was sick, and I said, Irving, I'll see you tomorrow. I can't go back to the office. So I went home and went to bed. I was absolutely so downcast. Then I came the next morning, and he said, who should introduce that song? And I said, well, it's a fast tempo, bouncy tune. I said, it really ought to go to Eddie Cantor. Pick up the phone. Eddie, I'm coming right over. He says, I got the goddamnedest song you ever heard. And he went through this routine again, so forth, and didn't ask Eddie, are you leaving the house, or have you got a date, or anything at all, and boom, come on. All right, went over, and I played the song and demonstrated it, and Cantor liked it very much, liked it right away. All right, song is sold to Cantor, right? No. Now Caesar did something that no professional songwriter ever does. Don't get into an argument with the plug you are talking to. You're trying to sell your song to him. Don't get into an argument about anything. That's one of the cardinal rules of the business. He says, Eddie, you know, a lot of radio stinks. Now, you're talking to a man who's got one of the biggest radio shows in the country, and you're telling him radio stinks? And I got sick again. Eddie says, well, some of radio, and Eddie is bouncing around the room, you know, he isn't sitting at all. He says, well, Irving, yeah, some, it isn't so good, so forth. No, it isn't so good. He says, Eddie, you don't have the time to sit down and listen to these programs the way other people do. They stink. In fact, he says, I know Henry Ford, and I'm writing Henry Ford a letter suggesting that he buy an hour once a week on all the radio stations. It will be called the Silent Hour, and this will be a sort of a vacation for the public. He said they won't have to listen to radio. That's how bad. Well, I'm sick and tired now, and I said, oh, Jesus. Yesterday we had it sold to Louis Bernstein for all kinds of money. Today we've got one of the biggest stars in the world who likes the song, and this guy again gets into an argument. And all of a sudden, Caesar got up and says, goodbye, Eddie, and went out. And I thought, geez, at least I ought to tell Cantor why we're here. We didn't come here to pick a fight. We came here to sell a song. So I went over to him and I said, thanks, I'm very glad that you like the song. He said, I said, and I hope that you will be singing it. And we went out again, went out of the San Remo apartments where he lived. And I said, Irving, I'm sick. I have to go home. And I went home again. I said, gee, I can't stand this. Why am I writing all these songs with this guy? And he gets into all kinds of arguments. Next morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. There is no such thing as 6 o'clock in the morning for a songwriter. The phone rings. My eyes are closed. It's Cantor on the phone. Said, Gerald, I'd like you to come over. Would you come over now and rehearse me on this song at 6 o'clock in the morning? I said, of course. Haven't opened my eyes yet. And he said, and I tell you what, I want to learn the song and do it this week on my program, because I'm afraid that if I don't sing it right away, somebody else will beat me to it and introduce it, because it's a hit. I said, fine, I'll be right over. I found my way to the bathroom, where I threw a little water on my eyes. I didn't even wash my face. And I put on some clothes, and I walked over to the San Remo apartment, and now about 6:30, and Cantor said, Gerald, as a bonus for your coming over, I'm going to make you fried eggs, toast, and coffee. I said, listen, that just the sound of that is vulgar to me. at 6:30 in the morning. I said, I can't stand it. Forget it. And I went to the piano and taught him the song. And from then on, he just sang it and sang it and sang it on I don't know how many programs. And every single time it was scheduled for a program of his, he called me up and said, at 6 o'clock in the morning, and said, Gerald, would you come over and rehearse me on the song? Now, he needed me to rehearse him on that song like I don't know what. He knew the song better than I did now. But I went over every time at 6 o'clock in the morning and rehearsed him. And I he sang it, and everybody, all the singers around, the professional singers, wanted copies of it immediately. I just want to finish by telling you that a little daughter of his by the name of Janet at the time was also bouncing around the room while I was there, and every time she came near Cantor, he gave her a little pat on her butt. You know who she is? His mother.
She's right over there.
Thank you very much.
And here's the song. Go ahead.
We go. Oh, Susanna, dust off the old piano. My hands are itching for those keys. Our troubles will go winging the moment we start singing all our favorite melodies. We'll get the gang around that used to hang around. And when the neighbors hear us singing Sally, they'll forget about Rudy Valley. Oh, Susanna, I'll let you sing soprano, dust off the old piano tonight. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, that's the scale everybody ought to know how to play from do to do. There is nothing finer than a minor strain. It's the kind of melody gets a lot of sympathy. Accord and C is beautiful, I heard somebody say it. Accord and G is wonderful, according to the way they play it. Oh, Susanna, dust off the old piano. My hands are reaching for those keys. It's been so many, many ages since we last turned the pages of our favorite melodies. We'll get the gang around that used to hang around. And when the neighbors hear a singing penna, they'll forget about a candidate tenor. Oh, Susanna, take off your old bandana, dust off the old piano.
Gerald Marks. Thank you again, Gerald. Well, one of the things that happened immediately thereafter, after the show that never aired and the RCA album coming out, is I wanted to get over to Columbia Records and try and get all of his Columbia songs out there, all the things he recorded for Columbia, because there had never been a collection before of all the things he recorded from 1922 to 1940. So I had approached them for many years and was turned down many times, but I did give them the RCA disc, and I think that's what got things started. And there was a lot of press happening also about the RCA recording and the Carnegie Hall. So what happened was, I approached Adam Block and Jerry Shulman over at Columbia, and they decided, yes, we're going to go with this. And their idea was to allow me to do a double CD of all the 44 titles that he had recorded for Columbia and for ARC. So I was just ecstatic. I thought it was just a wonderful thing to be able to put this together. And I booked time at their studios, Sony Studios, but they didn't have most of the masters. Almost all of them were gone. So I had to research all over the country to try to find collectors like yourselves who had these rare 78s. And certainly mint quality 78s. And one of the people that did have these was a man by the name of Joe Franklin, whom you probably know from radio and television. And he had some that had never been played before. So I used a lot of those. And I remember I came armed with all these 78s into Sony Studios, because that was where I had to do these transfers. I couldn't use Seth this time. So I went into Sony Studios, and I walk in, and there's another session booked. Same time. And here I had all my stuff all ready, and I went back to the to Adam Block, and I said very nicely, I said, you know, I had my day set aside, I had all these 78s I was carrying with me, and they double booked the time, plus the fact that, you know, I work with Seth, and he's brilliant at this. Is there any possibility that we can do anything to change what the situation is here? And in a rare move on his part, but I certainly respected the what he did, he booked Seth to work on this project with me. And I went out to Seth's studios in Brooklyn, and I remember going out there for many, many, many hours working on this, of trying to get the best quality on this Sony Legacy, Columbia Legacy double CD, and wrote all the liner notes for it. And we actually have it out now, and it sold 3,000 copies inside of 30 days. So I was very pleased with how that turned out. One thing I also always want to mention is there were three sides that were missing, and if anybody knows where these are and have found them anywhere, boy, am I looking for these. One is called Eddie's Trip Abroad, which is just a monologue recording, as well as Jake the Plumber, which I think might have been a monologue, but there could have been some music behind it. And then the earliest version of We're Back Together Again, which is on the album in the later version, but there was an earlier recording. So if anybody knows where these are, still looking for them. One bonus I'd like to play for you here today is Seth and I have been working on a whole lot of other projects, because a lady by the name of Patty Lewis, who was the former Mrs. Jerry Lewis, called me up after she had seen me on Entertainment Tonight and had mentioned that she had a stack of discs, more than just a stack, actually, out in storage in California. And she was moving, and she wanted to know if I wanted them. And I said, well, what are they? She says, I think they're old radio shows of your grandfather's. And I said, well, I guess I should come out there. She says, oh, absolutely, because I don't know what else to do with them. Maybe I could donate them somewhere. I said, no, donate them to me. I'd like them. So I get out to California, and I'm flabbergasted, because it's every radio show practically that he had ever done since 1931. So I was amazed, and they had all been stored pretty nicely too, even the wartime glass discs. So, but getting these back to New York, because I'm working with Seth on these things, was going to be, once again, a very difficult task. Till I called Wilfried Wald, and he said, speak to Stephen Lasker once again. And Stephen was incredible and helped me pack these things up. It was really all his doing. And we worked on getting these wooden crates and all this stuff together and shipped them back to New York. We took the glass discs and transferred them out there in California, got them back to New York. And one of the things that we transferred was a very rare 1935 show. But it proved one thing, that my grandfather really did write a big hit song. And I think you're going to recognize what this song is. And this was from a 1935 radio broadcast. Oh, sorry. This is from Columbia. This is a Legacy recording.
I have got a sweetie known as Susie. In the words of Shakespeare, she's a wow.
This is the first version of If You Knew
Though
Susie.
All of you may know her too.
And I've combined it
like to
with the later
right
version,
now.
Both on Columbia.
If you knew Susie like I know Susie, oh, 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 what a girl. There's none so classy as this fair lassie. Oh, 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 my goodness, what a chassis. We went riding, she didn't balk. From the country, I'm the one that had to walk. If you knew Susie like I know Susie, oh, oh, what a girl.
There is nobody quite like Susie.
This is from 1940,
my head gets
39.
I don't know if I'm going hither or thither, cause I'm in a dither since I met that loving baby of mine. You'd go for for Susie if you do, and no one holds a candle to her. Oh, oh, and Pietro, her lips are like Miss Hedy Lamarr's, and when she hugs me, it's like Tarzan. Oh, oh, to be specific, she's terrific. Out in public, she's meek and mild. But on a sofa, oh, fireman, fireman, save my child. If you do, Susie, like I know Susie. Oh, nice work for a grandfather, ain't it?
So those are two versions of If You Knew Susie. And his reference to being a grandfather was not because of me. I'm not that old yet. So anyway, I'm going to play you really quickly now. This is the 1935 recording. I think you'll recognize this song, which he actually wrote. I think it's track 7. We go.
And now, here's Eddie Cantor.
Too many frowns can change the brightest disposition, as sure as clouds can darken the dawn. Yet every joy in life has been our one ambition, and that's how we intend to go on. Merrily we roll along, my honey and me. Verily, there's no one half as happy as we.
If you recognize
it. Oh, it's wise as poor as my say, what do we care? For we've been so wealthy in the love that we share. Merrily, we dance along while facing the sun. Verily, our slogan is, say, don't we have fun? We live in style with a smile and a song as we merrily roll along. We roll along, my honey and me. Why we get along is very easy to see. He and I won't buy unless we pay for it cash. And we still enjoy the thrill of corned beef and hash. Though we often quarrel for it, human, I'm sure. Still we find there's nothing that a kiss cannot cure. We're for each other, how can we go wrong as we merrily roll along?
I think that's a great tune, great little tune there. The last thing I'd like to play for you now is, also I want to mention one thing. There was a lady in West Virginia named Sheila Riddle who's been so impressed with my grandfather for so long now that she decided she was going to start the Eddie Cantor Appreciation Society, and it is with my full blessing and my whole family's blessing, and she's been doing a great job. And we actually have applications up here in case you do want to join, as well as a little bonus that Legacy has provided that you can get the new Eddie Cantor Legacy CD via an 800 number. So those flyers are up there too if anybody wants to take them afterwards. And the last thing I was going to play for you is something that I've been working on, because not only do I produce these reissue CDs, but I, as Seth had mentioned earlier, I had a show on Broadway some years ago, and I'm looking forward to actually putting together a Broadway show on my grandfather that I'll have written, and I've written 7 songs for it. And one song that I wrote that is on my album right now, my solo album, is a song called It's Harder to Hit a Moving Target, and it is actually based on words that he said of why he was on the, how he escaped being egged and tomatoed and all those things on the vaudeville stage. And when I wrote the song, I decided to write it not only in the style of something that he would sing, but also when I recorded it, I wanted to sing it in the style and make the recording like a record that I had been working on, actually, like these Columbia Legacy recordings. So this is it. This is It's Harder to Hit a Moving Target with me singing.
Tried to hit the stage before, but somehow it hit me. If war is what it's all about, then that's how it must be. And so I tried to think of any way I could survive. Well, maybe if I jumped around, I'd leave the stage alive. Oh, it's harder to hit a moving target. It's harder when you don't stay in one place. I tried to recite a little verse, but in no time they were sending for a nurse. It's harder to hit a moving target. such a pretty face. Now Miners on the Bowery is one place I must try. I hear that you could win a fit, that is if you don't die. So that's where I am going, even though they say it's hard. There's one thing I'll remember, so they won't catch me off guard. Oh, it's harder to hit a moving target. It's harder when you catch them by surprise. I tried to sing a song while standing still, and that's when they all came in for the kill. It's harder to hit a moving target, or someone who just rolls his eyes. But I've got $5 more tonight. Now am I such a putz? So maybe I've got something that the people do enjoy. I show up here, I end up there, like some kid's wind-up toy. Oh, it's harder to hit a moving target. It's harder when they cannot figure how. When somebody yelled, go get the hook. If I stood around, I'd be a schnook. It's harder to hit a moving target. That's why I must leave right now.
Thank you. Thank you. I know we have, like, just about a minute or two for questions and answers, so, yes.
In my publication, we literally had hundreds of Eddie Cantor records.
Mm-hmm.
Going all the way back, I guess when you were not even born.
Right.
Okay, now here, I have a question here about a very unusual recording.
Okay.
An RCA record of, I'm trying to read the small print.
Okay. We don't have too much time.
Okay.
It's only fairly.
This is reminiscing with Eddie Cantor on one side, and Ralph Flanagan introducing his Bluebird records on the other side.
Right.
Do you have this recording?
It's Eddie Cantor doing what on what side?
Reminiscing.
Yes, I do have it. I have a copy of it, a tape of it.
A tape. Yep. Well, we had, in this last auction, we had it, the original.
You did?
Brand new shape.
Oh, boy. That's great. That's great. Hey, we have another question here.
Can you give me the background of the recordings of 78 you made for Pan American, where you sang with Rafael Mendez and a Latin American artist?
Well, I think that was done in the 40s, somewhere in the 40s. And my grandfather would record for any label that would have him. He was, he came from the old school. I asked this question, too, of a couple of people. He had this attitude where he could do a job for $1,000 out, you know, in upstate New York. And while he was coming down the road, if he saw a place that would book him for $200, he'd work $200 on his way back. That was his policy. And it's a policy of a lot of vaudevillians from that time. They would just grab those jobs. Yes, one.
The introductions to those songs for Victor that were issued on the 57 but not on the stereo reissues, were the original introductions recorded only in mono?
Probably not. The only thing is that RCA was very careful not to let me go into any kind of vaults and not to let me go near anything. So I've got a feeling there is a tape, which I will look for. If they allow me to do the volume 2, I'm going to go back and see if I can find that tape and push them a little further and maybe find some outtakes on there.
Was that echo that was on there from the original 55-56 recording, or?
Nothing was really changed on that.
That wasn't an echo, that was their horrible echo.
Yeah, 1957, that's sort of their idea of sound, yes?
Two more questions, I'll be very fast, because you only got about 30 seconds left.
I know.
Okay. did Eddie ever make any recordings on the pseudonyms?
No, not that I know of. Mom, I don't think so, right?
Number two. Number two is the stuff. Did you folks ever work on the Pathé, the
Not yet, but that's
also the,
in the works.
I have them in my auction now.
Yes.
But the Pathé, where he sang on the, we had two of them.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you know, those are real early things.
Yes, I do.
And how about Emerson?
Emerson, I am planning to do something on the Emersons. I'm planning to do something on all of these. If it doesn't happen immediately, it's just that I don't want to flood the market right now because there are 4 CDs out right now on him, and I hope that all of you that are interested in Eddie Cantor will have them in your collection because I think they're all, each one is worthwhile. Yes, you have a question.
How did Sherry Lewis get those records?
No, it wasn't Sherry Lewis, but even that's the puppeteer, and even though this was like working it like a puppet, Jerry Lewis is Patty Lewis. How did she get them? My grandfather gave them to the family and just
I think my grandfather didn't see any value to those and didn't really, or whatever value he saw, he thought somebody else would do better with them than he would in his later years. He gave it to them in the 50s. Well, yeah, and Jerry's a big collector, yeah. But they were just sitting there. Nobody was bothering with them, and I'm really trying to preserve them with Seth's added. In fact, we should have a hand for Seth and all the work he did here. Again, if anybody wants any of the applications for the Society, they're right up front here, and the Legacy Flyer is right there with the 800 number. And thank you all very much for having me here today. I appreciate it very much.